Please welcome to the upper stage, Jeffrey Donaldson.
Are we allowed to bring beer up? Is there like a license line that goes along the front? You can't bring beer up to the table. I'm going to set my cell phone so that I will self-destruct at 20 minutes. Yeah, I have. I've lived in Hamilton now for 21 years. Hamilton, Southern Ontario's best kept secret. I know what you all think of Hamilton from what I used to think of Hamilton. It's what you see when you go over the Burlington Skyway. You see the Satanic Mills in the distance, but those are really the gates of fire that we put up so that people won't come in and see the Niagara Escarpment behind us. We always think of going up to Barrie, right? You have to go to Barrie to get out into nature, but it's all about Hamilton. Okay, I'm just going to read one book, one poem from my first book. Last book, called Palilalia. And I'd like to read it for my friends Peter Newman and Amanda Jernigan and Susan Warner Keene, who are here. They are respectively editors and trustees of the estate of one of Canada's finest poets, Richard Outram, who died in 2005, and Amanda Jernigan has brought out a selected poems of his that was only a couple of hours ago launched very elegantly and successfully downtown. And this is a poem that's not about Richard, but I dedicated it to him because it had in it some of the things that he and I used to talk a little bit about. And I hope it has something of his spirit in it still. So it's called Let, and it's a poem that just sort of plays on the on that word that we get repeatedly at the beginning of the book of Genesis in the Old Testament: let there be light, let the waters separate from the waters, and so on. The particular meaning of that let is fascinating to me, and so I tried to write a poem about it. And I mixed it in with some reflections on how poorly I used to do in mathematics in high school. God was good with words. He knew it. He turned a phrase and said, "Let there be light," held it up in the darkness, then threw it down before our dazzled sight. Not, "It's time, light, you should start to be," or, "Stand back, folks, I'm gonna make some light." But just the right words to set, oh, nothing, free at the right time, a calculated ought. He knew the secrets of our wistful let, the "what would happen if" subjunctive spell, not the ex nihilo erector set of scaffolding and girders, where the hell you fashion from hard irons bound to break for aught made out of knots, illusion still, but now say let for mere allowance's sake, and openings will fill with what you will. Flash back to mathematics class in school, the teacher brooding tall at his blank slate like a deity, makes you seem a fool by writing out long formulas of great impenetrable equations undefined, a Sanskrit algebra of XY pairs ramified in patterns out of mind, a sprawling orrery of whirling stars that I must somehow solve when teacher says in his English brogue, "Let X equal light." Did I hear that straight? Come again, sir, please. And his patience thins. Let it equal it. What is your answer now? I stare in the abyss. It escaped me then, the longed for solving grace, that the world is nothing but hypothesis. Its great unknowns, the cosmos, time and space, all algorithms of what might appear, were worlds made out of, would that it were so. I might have just replied, had I God's ear, "Better than nothing, sir, for all I know." One, two, three, hang on, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven poems, I think. So you can, if you want to make a little tick, you know, you'll know exactly where we are and how much longer you have to wait before I sit down. I'll start with a poem called "On Reading When You Are Old." On Reading When You Are Old, and it's meant to be a poem. There's a wonderful poem, probably many of you are familiar with it, by W.B. Yeats, called "When You Are Old." When you are old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once in other shadows deep, and so on. there are only three more stanzas. I couldn't get through it. So this is "On Reading When You Are Old," and also "On Reading When You Are Old," the Yeats poem. It's for Annette. The number of things we have said to each other about love is as endless as we are. But time, if memory serves, has written some of them down for us and made a kind of book, one that has no title on the cover and lacks chapter breaks to help readers by lamplight on solitary evenings know where the rests fall, where to fold a page corner or set a bookmark to find the place once more when they come back to it. And to be honest, we have found little time for reading, though we have watched the book grow heavier with unseparated pages thin as India paper and covered with words we imagined we were still waiting for, the words that once we found them, we always said we would read together in time. It is like those nights when you dream about writing and your pen flits back and forth across the page with a scratching sound and the ink runs and every least scribble seems like a line from a poem, perhaps even, though it is still all but obscured, the love poem you had long planned to write. And you look down to see what it says and find that none of it makes any sense because there were no words, or only words so long as you didn't try to read them. And the knowledge brings you back, and you wake in the early light and look about you and see a book on the bedside table with the bookmark set somewhere near the beginning, and you realize how you couldn't say that you are the solitary reader. This is a poem called "A Note to My Poem," and it's just a little fantasy. Maybe we all have it, that on your dying day, what is it you want to say to your poems as you leave the world? Or do you want to ignore them and pretend you don't know them? This is "A Note to My Poem." Listen, you and I have come a long way since that first time we set out together among the river clouds in the evening and found the paper trees cool to the touch after the sun went down, and shared a word about them, and were surprised, like first-time lovers, to find ourselves, as we always joked, on the same page. Those were days when following the river turns was only an excuse to get more closely in touch with our shared feelings, making up stories about them we knew the other would love, racing to finish one another's sentences. And there was that windy day when we said the river and the trees beside it were the same as us, that with a bittersweet longing they too had appeared in search of purposes they thought they lacked and found only ourselves reaching out to them and the breezes that were passing there anyway. And we laughed, for the river had no eyes to find its way and the trees only followed along because it was water and they were thirsty. And as for us, I know as time went on that we grew impatient with what the other seemed incapable of saying, or even worse, refused to say, when it would have solved everything just to have heard it spoken. And we had to forgive each other for that silence, and were never certain that we had. Now I have used up my time and left you alone here, repeating to yourself, not even aloud or where any listener is likely to hear you, the line about the river and how it looked, the line about the trees and the indifferent breezes that sadly in the end they had to settle for, how there was always something in them that we missed. But say it as often as you can and put in a word for me if you think of it. You see, if you're going to applaud after every poem, then if you don't applaud, then I'm going to have to tear that poem from the book. disown it, so we need to be careful.
Writing about writing, writing about words. That's the first thing I noted about your reading, that there was always a...
I guess part of that comes just out of teaching poetry all the time. I'm constantly invited by my students when you're standing in front of 200 or 300 students who are waiting for you to say something about a poem. It inspires reflections that you wouldn't necessarily have come to otherwise. So I get to, I'm blessed in that I get to do a lot of thinking about poetry, and I'm very interested in the creative process, as most poets would be, and I like to try and reflect on, sort of metaphorically, on the different ways in which you inhabit words and words inhabit you. And right now I'm trying to plan a series of poems that are about the poem as dot, 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 right? So the poem as... garbage picker-upper. There's a proper word for that. What is it? Poem as empty pool, or poem as car accident, right? And then you would just sort of try and allegorize that a little bit, run it through your mind, as you know, you're following a narrative through that is a car accident, but what people recognize as they're looking at the poem is that what you're really describing is the process of writing, or the process of a poem unfolding.
So have some of your poems been cobbled together from your lecture notes?
No. That's a cool idea, though. I have to think about that as a possibility. It might actually be the other way around.
Poem as lecture notes. So it could be.
That's right. I'm going to use that. Thank you. Poem as lecture note. Yeah. I tend not to there's a certain line, you know, you want to approach your lecture material imaginatively, and you want to have a certain critical thoughtful component to your poems, but in some ways I do see them as separate worlds in terms of the kinds of concentration they bring out of me.
Okay, and Interpuck, which is funny because we're getting to the kind of, you know, the very kind of, you know, meta-referential sort of, yes, you know, poem. And then you have the hockey poem, which is the other thing. Do I even have a question about that? are you a student of the hockey poem? Because there's been many, I know.
Yes, I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't been, and after I had done this series, I went and looked with some embarrassment at how I had been anticipated so brilliantly, with my, you know, and bringing only my own small contribution to the literature, which strikes me as interesting in Canada, right? An enormous cultural phenomenon like the hockey game, and of course, writers are going to engage with it in the ways that they can. And so I hoped that my poems would bring a certain perspective to it. And in some ways, they're not really about hockey at all. They take the moments in the game and they enlarge on them in sort of spiritual and metaphysical ways. And as with the poem Face Off that I read, they're sort of about... That one's about the process of writing itself. So I'm usually trying to get some other kind of work done in it. But I really found that they happened really quickly, and that I was getting something out of myself that had been latent within me, I guess, for decades since I'd stopped playing. The poem Enter Puck itself is a fictional poem about being in a classroom in high school and mistaking... When a teacher who's teaching Midsummer Night's Dream tells me, because I'm daydreaming so much, to start reading from a certain line in the Midsummer Night's Dream, she says, "Begin with Enter Puck." And I think that she's talking about hockey. And that throws me into a tailspin, and then the poem is about how those two worlds, the creative, imaginative, and literary world, and then the hockey world, become strangely intermingled, so that Puck, the spirit in Shakespeare, becomes like a hockey puck in my mind, and I see them sort of dancing around in my head in the same way. So that was kind of fun to work out, too.
I think that thought occurred to me at one point in my life. I completely forgot. But thank you very much.
Sure.
There are several series of poems in Guesswork. The one that I'd like to read a couple of poems now are joining the burgeoning tradition, as I gather, of hockey poems in Canada. I grew up in the north end of Toronto in what's now, I guess, called the Jean Finch Corridor, and did nothing after school but play hockey with rain-soaked sponge pads and wet toques that dropped over your eyes, and never did any schoolwork at all until fourth year university, I think. So I'd sort of let the hockey go as I moved through university, but it's always been with me, and you know, I'm a long-suffering Leaf fan and so on. And so I finally paid my dues to those many years by writing a series of hockey poems in a cycle called Enter Puck. I take a series of moments in a hockey game or hockey positions, and I just reflect on them in various metaphysical and often, I suppose, spiritual ways. But I'll just start with a poem called Face Off, which is really about writing poems. You won't be surprised to learn. There would be no false starts. Every pending poem would open with a graceful wink like this, a sudden falling into medias res, a pointed and symmetrical easing back into chaotic flows and the myriad incalculable momentums. Moments ago, you were a team player, circled away from your impasse and allowed another line's fresher approach to come forward. And in the pause, you took stock of where you had got to when the thing you were after was lost sight of and you found yourself pushing hard against your own worst enemy. Now a light tap on the shoulder, you muse, is all you need to feel summoned again, called to rise up and glide widely towards the waiting one who holds, who keeps, who knows when the time has come, who lowers his hands and, not showing when, with a flourish, drops at your feet that single point you will scramble to control. And truth be told, that's how you like it, since in best worlds, you never know when the good thing to play with will fall to you out of nowhere, only that you agree once more to see what might happen if it did. So you enter the zone, the inner circle, and already ready, drift imperceptibly closer to the zero point, hunch over your work, and expecting nothing, take what is freely given. So I was a defenseman, and I was in a house league where you paid to play, and I was probably in that house league of one of the players who paid to play, one of the worst players playing, but I loved it. And I had a line in here about how badly I skated. It's in a different poem, though. But it's relevant to would-be action hero. I was the too eager, rotten defenseman, skated backwards as though on stilts and turned like a man digging dirt out with a shovel. Not graceful. Anyway, so that's what you want to picture. As the defenseman, but this is the poem about the defenseman and everything the defenseman means. Zen artists, they look at everything backwards. The game isn't about getting ahead, it's about not falling any farther behind than we already are. The rest is out of our hands. They see how things go, that we always face the future in reverse, the way Eliot said we ride on subway cars, seated backwards, the past receding, and God knows what lies behind us up ahead. When the play turns, they like to give ground, take the adversary as he comes, as a disciple might. They prostrate themselves, they fall upon their knees. They put themselves in the way of danger for the greater good, and are prepared to do serious time if it means one last shot in the world. They don't shy from people, but prefer to see the painful give and take, the alarming scrimmage constantly pulling away from them into the distance. In moments of crisis, they are not aloof, work to remove obstacles and clear views. Cowboys at heart, they can circle the wagons, face showdowns one-on-one, grapple feisty ones broken loose, stare down the six shooters. Their sticks are tools, not to carry pucks, but to work things loose, leverage, thread, cantilever, and divide. They go into corners with the measured eye of a carpenter. They have seen too many fast ones slip past, but believe that an honest man can learn from experience if he tries. Is it wisdom or cowardice that when their own side drives headlong at sudden opportunities, they hang back, cautious and doubtful, certain that what they do to others in turn will be done to them sooner or later? Forwards thrive on the dicey squeak through, the puck come billiard ball's indeterminate calculus. Defensemen chide deflections and would no more live by chance than a god does. When opponent's salvos fail, the goal unscored, the narrow miss, the fans a blink that the team has dodged a bad end, they drift off to their rest, faithful that nothing happens for a reason. This is called Some Things You Can Do With the Day When the Day Is Over. I know that's something everybody wants to know about. We have all of these days lying around that we've already used up. What are you going to do with them? Some things you can do with the day when the day is over. And it's one of those list poems. You can take it up to the attic in a square box. You can paste it into a scrapbook of days in the empty space marked yesterday. You can list it in the classifieds under miscellaneous. You can walk away from it, and if it is still there, you can walk faster. You can take your shoes off and lay them beside it. You can be polite and say, we should get together again sometime. You can say that you wish things had worked out differently. You can put it at the curb in the recycling bin. You can explain how grieving doesn't help, it is still over. You can ask it what being over is like. You can use it for parts. You can come clean and confess that it wasn't your day. You can become a day whisperer, sit cross-legged at a distance until it comes to you. You can lie and say there is no one to blame. You can put it in the mail, addressed to yourself. You can hold it for questioning. You can lie down beside it on a clear night and count the stars. You can try to find one like it among the constellations. You can put off thinking about it until tomorrow. You can tell it the story of the return of the prodigal son. You can make a sculpture of it, starting with a block of wood.